city, flickering dirty neon over alleys mean and dirty streets, while my neighborhood is torn down around me.
Hello, everybody. It is a Sunday, the 11th of August in 2013. Yes. We are here at a nightclub at the end of the world, wading our way through life's challenges. We've had a few of those, including for our guest tonight. I want to make sure that I've been told that Guy is standing behind the line. We are here at a moment in time when Fukushima is front and center in front of the whole world. We will deal with that tonight. I'm going to bring a guy on first, but a couple of things I want to share. If you follow me on Facebook, you'll see that on Thursday morning, I was super pleased to open to receive a UPS bundle, and it was three copies of my book, Confronting Collapse, The Crisis of Energy and Money in a Post-Peak Oil World, from Chelsea Green Publishing. And the cool part that I got three copies of was that they were in Chinese. The book has been translated, and I was really overjoyed with that. But, of course, there is a great irony in that, and that I wrote the book in 2009, and that was the time when it should have reached the Chinese market. There's not too much time left to really do much with that, except for to comprehend our situation and see what benefit derives from that. I received a nice poem this week that I want to share with you, and I'm going to share at the end of the show a great letter I got from a friend in Nicaragua this week. But Ronald Helms wrote a poem on my Facebook page, and he listened to an interview I did on a British radio station this week, Tuesday. But he wrote A Moment of Silence is what it's called. And he wrote, years pass and nature stands silent, compliant, taking lash after lash like a mentally retarded child, beaten without comprehension of why. I hope if there is consciousness in this universe, it will ask for a moment of silence, just one eternity, no more, in memory of nature's unwavering sacrifice to humanity, to every theft and every lie. That was a really nice piece of writing there. The weather is out there doing what it does, and we have massive flooding in eastern Russia now, in the central U.S., Missouri, Kansas, the East Coast, wildfires. All of the horrors of climate change are still in full swing and accelerating. Our guest tonight, Guy McPherson, has done seminal work in the field of bringing this to public attention, but I never thought he'd be upstaged by a nuclear plant. We will talk to our chagrin about that as we become, instead of scientist and journalist or scientist and interviewer, two brothers, two human beings, just talking with the common sense and what's available to us. Guy McPherson is a professor emeritus of natural resources and ecology and evolutionary biology from the University of Arizona. And most of you know him very well. He's a dear friend to all of us here, as well as on Facebook. But more than 10 years into his career in the academic ivory tower, Guy began focusing his efforts on social criticism with topics ranging from education and evolution to the twin sides of the fossil fuel coin. His public appearances stress these two predicaments because each of them informs and impacts every aspect of life on Earth. We're seeing that at a new level tonight. Guy's contemporary presentation stressed the importance of individual and societal action in light of ongoing global change and energy decline, but we have another major card in the picture tonight, and I'm sure we're going to talk a lot about that. Wrote a book, Walking Away from Empire. His website, Nature Bats Last, GuyMcPherson.com, was seriously hacked recently while Guy was in Europe. We will talk to him about that. And you should also know Guy from an amazing film released just a few months ago called Somewhere in New Mexico, Before the End of Time. He has, to a certain extent, upstaged me as the Cassandra of Doom, but now you got us both together, and we are not going to have any mercy with you tonight. Guy McPherson, welcome back to the Lifeboat Hour.
Thanks very much, Mike. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
When did you get back from Europe?
Late last night. Ended a 24-hour day last night about 10 o'clock, and got 4 or 5 hours of sleep.
Well, you're a youngster. You'll be fine in a short period of time, I'm sure.
they'll be fully recovered in another couple or 3 weeks, or maybe a month.
I think that what we'll do to start is, I'm just going to give some brief updates on Fukushima because it is kind of upstaging everything. And what we know from a plethora of well-sourced stories, I'm talking about Reuters, ENE News, Asahi News Agency, Japan Times, the Japanese government, TEPCO, ad infinitum, these stories are out there clearly. And the picture that confronts us as human beings and as a planet tonight is that we know that three cores have gone China syndrome, melted down to a level where we know that the radiation now at Fukushima gets stronger the deeper you go in the ground. That's what we call in police work a clue. Multiple admissions that TEPCO has lied for since the earthquake that I'm sure it's at least 400 tons, although the press seems to be rewriting numbers as if that makes a difference at this point, per day of radioactive water going into the Pacific Ocean, overrunning a barrier. Russia today has reported that the radioactive water has overflowed the existing barrier by 60 centimeters, almost 5 feet, and multiple clear statements from very respected nuclear scientists like Arne Gunderson, like Chris Busby, and like Helen Caldicott, that what is of concern also now to all of them is the fact that this massive flow of groundwater flowing off a mountainside underneath and now to which is added the enormous pumping of water to try to keep what they can keep cool, especially two sets of fuel rods, MOX fuel rods stored on top of buildings 3 and 4 cool, which is probably where most of the contamination is coming from, but is actually undermining buildings 3 and 4. And I was, you know, I've been aware of this for a long time, but Arne Gunderson himself raised the statement this week, the possibility this week that we could be looking at the collapse of building 3 or 4, which would expose 20-plus years of spent fuel rods to open-air fusion reaction. This is a total game-changer, isn't it, Guy?
Absolutely. If any of those are MOX, and I assume they are,
yes,
then it's an unmitigated disaster that could very well lead to the loss of a huge number of human lives in the very short term.
I recall Arne Gunderson in the first weeks, perhaps first 2 months after the earthquake and tsunami, saying that no one has ever conceived what an open-air, uncontrolled fusion reaction of that amount of fuel would do. And even he, I believe at that time, said, you know, it could be enough to set the atmosphere on fire, absolutely unknown consequences. But I was going to play a video, an audio clip of Helen Caldicott, which I somehow lost out on my script and didn't have time to go refine again. But this brings to mind a very important question for you, which I totally know that you are competent to answer. Those amounts of becquerels of radiation pouring into the Pacific Ocean now for 2 years already will have unmitigated impact on the food chain and life in the Pacific Ocean. Can you perhaps tell us, talk to us about that?
Well, it's the world's biggest ocean, and the marine food chain, marine systems, account for about half of the food humans currently eat. It appears extremely likely at this point that it's not an if, but a given, that there is considerable contamination. In fact, I keep seeing news reports of every item that's tested, every piece of tuna, every piece of salmon, and so on that's tested, is off the charts in terms of contamination and being unsafe for human consumption. The government response to this is expected in that the federal government keeps raising the safety standards.
Mm-hmm.
But that's no solution. That's just denying that we have a problem.
Right.
So this is a catastrophe. It's difficult to imagine how bad this is, and as usual, of course, the corporate media and the corporate government are downplaying or ignoring the situation completely.
Off the off the top of your head, and I'm sure it'll be much more deep than that. We have this proposal from Shinzo Abe, the Japanese Prime Minister, to construct, I'm sorry, I'm laughing as I say this, a huge wall of ice around the reactor. Do you have any comment on that?
Oh, this is the very height of wishful thinking.
Yes, to say the least.
Jeez, this is just, if you wanted to design a system that would have the worst possible outcome, take every step along the way that's a disaster. You couldn't have done any better than this, or in this case, any worse.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're talking about having to pump water onto the thing forever. We're talking about technology that might be available in 2020 to deal with the problem. I mean, every possible outcome is an unmitigated disaster.
When they say pump water on it forever, my mind envisions a cup, a container, a bowl to hold all this forever water. Is that possible? How can that be done?
Well, I think what they're talking about is just pumping contaminated ocean water directly onto the system so that it flows back into the ocean. And it just keeps making the ocean more and more contaminated, but prevents it from going into the atmosphere. That's the only thing I can figure out. So they're trying to delay the catastrophic disaster that airborne particles would be.
One of the points that I have heard Helen Caldicott make repeatedly and very eloquently, I'm sorry I didn't have that clip, and Chris Busby also, but as that, we would assume that the radiation is absorbed at the lowest level of the food chain, the microorganisms, the algae, the plankton, so on and so forth. But they have said that it concentrates the higher you go up the food chain. Is that correct?
Yes, this is... As I understand it, this is another case of biomagnification. And it happens, and it's well known from as far back as the early 1960s with Rachel Carson's work in Silent Spring,
mm-hmm.
that organisms higher on the food chain experience magnification at every step along the way.
Magnification, e.g., or i.e., concentration, then?
Yes, okay. Exactly. Increased concentration as you go further up the food chain.
Naively speaking, someone who lives in a disconnected world who lives on the Pacific coast of the United States saying, well, that's okay. We catch our tuna off of Baja California or our salmon off of Oregon. That's a really bad way to view things, yes?
Yes, absolutely. And I keep reading and hearing that, oh, hey, it's 5,000 miles from our coast, really nothing to worry about.
Your response to that is how long before we should start worrying? And my answer, maybe your answer was 2 years ago? What?
Yeah, about 2.5 years ago is when we maybe should start worrying about this.
Well, we have passed so many opportunities, and we'll work back around toward that theme. One of my friends on Facebook submitted what I thought was a really terrific question for you. It's from Matt Rawlings. He wrote, Mike, I'm sure you've already got a bunch of questions for Guy, but if there's time, could you ask him this question? In what way does climate change adversely affect local ecosystems that would be obvious to an ecologist but maybe not so obvious to the layman? In other words, what I think he's saying is, how can you spot the signs of either climate change or now we would throw radiation into the mix if you're a layman walking around?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and I like his emphasis on local, because these will be local events that we will be witnessing. For example, we're already seeing, and there's a wonderful paper in February 2012 in Bioscience that points out the early flowering dates of plants around Concord, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And so the researchers went out, Primack and others went out and, first of all, transcribed Henry David Thoreau's notes from the 1840s on first flowering dates of plants, and then went out again about 170 years later and recorded the flowering dates, and they'd shifted enough to suggest a 2.4 degree centigrade increase in temperatures during that time. That's a minor example. Most of us aren't paying close enough attention from year to year, much less over a span of decades, what is happening with flowering plants. But what we can see is plants that go away. So, hey, where I live, plants X, Y, and Z used to be common, and now they're not. And plants A, B, and C suddenly are all over the place. When I was conducting research in southern Arizona for many years, there was a plant, a non-native plant from South Africa called lemon lovegrass, that was not at all evident. It might have been present, but it wasn't evident on my field sites for the first several years. So this takes us through the early 1990s. By the time we got to the mid-2000s, 2005 or so, it was the dominant species throughout the whole area. So in a decadal period, this became the dominant plant in an area, and that likely was a result of increased winter temperatures. And so that's just one aspect. In addition, what we're going to see in the not-too-distant future is the temperatures rise in some places sufficiently to cause proteins to denature and kill many of the plants. Maybe even all of the plants in an area. And then after that, we have the dust bowl that never ends and people choke to death. Farmers, ranchers, people who are working on the land and observing the land every day see these changes as they occur, as they play out in real time. Most of us spend so little time out on the land, especially people who live in cities and towns, that we just have no idea what's going on around us. Take a trip through the northern and central Rockies and look at all the dead trees. In fact, throughout North America, you can see lots of dead trees, but they're particularly obvious in coniferous forests because the needles are all turn red. So how this plays out depends on your local ecosystem, and there will be many and varied responses to changes in climate and ultimately changes in weather. Increased freeze, for example. Two out of the last 4 years here in Tucson, Arizona, where I'm staying with friends, experienced winter cold temperatures, cold enough to cause citrus trees to die back to the base. These are 80 to 100-year-old citrus trees that have been hanging around for many, many years. Now, two out of the last four years, we've had extreme killing freezes because of the meandering of the jet stream. And so it's too cold, it's too hot, it's too dry, it's too wet, it's all of the above. And it just depends on where you're at.
So paying attention to what's happening locally will make the most immediate, and I think it's really fair of us to couch this now, that we are talking about people's short and medium-term survival, because from a great many perspectives, there is no long-term survival available at this point. As we turn to weather, and then I'm kind of come back to talk about what happened to you last week, then we'll take some calls. As I turn back to weather, what has developed of late? What is new in terms of climate collapse that people should be aware of?
Well, interestingly, since I talked to you in April, yes, it was only April. We've learned that we've triggered another six self-reinforcing feedback loops. Six. Since April have been reported in the Refereed Journal literature. And I was still delivering a presentation at a hacker conference in the Netherlands, and I presented information, and then somebody asked me to do the same presentation or an update of it 4 days later. Well, about 4 days later, we got word in the journal literature that we triggered another one. That was in Nature Climate Change just a week ago. So it's astonishing to me how quickly these events are playing out. We're seeing geological events play out in real time. We know of the reported literature of one self-reinforcing feedback loop in 2010, and then four in 2011, and then six in 2012, and eight so far in 2013.
Which brings up an obvious question. What, if any, interreaction is there, might there be, between Fukushima and the climate right now? Anything we have to look for, in, you know, in terms of crossover?
I don't know. I just don't know of the potential interactions there. So, since I don't know it, I'm taking the rare occasion to not say anything about it.
That's a great option. I'm sure that there would be a lot of people out there curious about that, so I just thought I would throw out. I'm pretty much inclined to agree with you. Who knows, but it could be anything at this point. When I did the show last week, or the week before, I commented extensively on an article by my friend Nafis Mossadegh Ahmed of The Guardian, showing that the top secret documents had disclosed that the United States Department of Defense was preparing at breakneck speed for massive, and I mean truly unprecedented, and I'm from the 60s, and I'm thinking unprecedented in terms of the 60s, amounts of social unrest, social displacement as a result of climate change catastrophe. Peak oil was listed in there. God, I hate to be vindicated this way. But that these preparations were extremely serious, and these documents also showed some were leaked in connection with Edward Snowden, showing that as far as the Department of Defense was concerned, environmental activists, terrorists, were like a total number one priority. And in the wake of all the revelations as a result of the Snowden scandal, I'm sure almost everybody should be experiencing some serious disruptions in the Internet one way or another now. But it was very clear that your website was attacked while you were in Amsterdam. Of course, I'm a veteran of that many times, and I sounded the alarm because that's the best defense we have to protect our most valuable resources, and you are definitely one of them, Guy McPherson. Is to raise the alarm quickly and draw attention to us. How did that play out, and what did you learn that you can share?
Well, I had just written a piece for Transition Voice. It came out, in fact, when I was en route to the conference, and that piece was exceptionally critical of the Obama administration, and it pointed out the inordinate surveillance state we have become, and the relative lack of interest and lack of response by most people in the United States. An hour after I arrived in the vicinity of the conference venue, my website was hacked and was down for the first time in 6 years. And it stayed down for 2.5 days until I finally got some help from somebody who just offered their help. I mean, I didn't even know how to get into the thing. I couldn't even log in at the login page. But immediately a handful of exceptional IT people wrote to me. I didn't know any of them, and offered to sort the thing out. And one of the first ones to write to me, I said, yes, sure, have a crack at it. Here's my login and my password. They're not doing me any good. I can't log in. You might as well. And he went in there and said, yep, it's been hacked. Somebody's changed the script. There's no way that happens unless somebody does it on purpose.
How long did it take to find that out?
It took him about an hour or so to figure it out, because
okay.
The new script was embedded in there. And it only took him and his IT team, and he said he has an exceptional IT team, and he's the CTO, which I assume is
Chief Technology Officer.
Right, Chief Technology Officer of this relatively small organization. It took them a total of about 4 or 5 hours to fix the whole thing and get it back up and running again.
But you had to find the right people with the right horsepower and the right knowledge to...
Absolutely, exactly. I didn't know anything.
Yeah,
I still don't know anything.
That's the key for all of us in these situations, and that's a bit of a teaching curve. Ed, now, your situation was not a DDoS, but when I was at CollapseNet, we were hit with a similarly brutal kind of attack, but it was DDoS that eventually we got to inside sources who said, yes, it was the equivalent of 200,000 personal computers being turned loose to deny your service. And obviously this was a different method, I would suspect more sophisticated.
But this was not accidental. And for the naive and the ones in denial out there, if you don't think that this was the United States government, I question your ability to understand anything that's going on with the rest of the show.
Well, and during the conference, Julian Assange was brought in by Livestream, and there was quite the battle behind the scenes between these hackers who organized and ran the conference and the NSA that was trying to prevent the live stream from getting in.
So they were all suited up, and they all understood from the gate that it was going to be Rocky Balboa versus Apollo Creed to get this conference up and the live stream done?
Absolutely. They've been doing this conference every 4 years since 1989, and they know what they're up against. They had more bandwidth at this conference than they have in Africa. They laid fiber optic cables 30 kilometers, buried them underground. The second night, there's only about 20 people who knew where that line was buried, by the way. The second night, somebody came in, took a piece of heavy machinery and cut it in half. These guys had it up and running in 25 minutes.
These guys know what's going on. That's encouraging.
Yes. Yes, these guys, and I use the colloquial, these people were astonishing in their understanding of the nature of the world and how we've become a surveillance state, their understanding and knowledge of what that means and how to overcome that. I mean, some of these people made thousands of euros a day when they were brought in by security teams to patch problems, and they all took time off from those jobs to go out and volunteer to help run this conference. It was impressive on every imaginable level for me, and not just because I'm a Luddite. These were just unbelievably knowledgeable people who were aware of what's going on in the world. I just don't encounter that much in my daily life. Most people I encounter are completely in denial about the nature of the U.S. government.
Let me just do a quick station ID. Ladies and gentlemen, we are going to run without a commercial break tonight. This is Michael C. Rupert, Tracker of Truth, here with you on the Lifeboat Hour on the Progressive Radio Network, August 11th, 2013. Guy, there is, I'm sure you've heard of it, the prophecy of the eagle and the condor, which originates in South America, but it's found all over the Western Hemisphere, which in spiritual terms says that one day the eagle and the condor shall fly wingtip to wingtip. And in one sense, it is interpreted very clearly that the heart, meaning the wisdom of the heart, the good motive, will fly wingtip to wingtip with the power of the human intellect in service, together paired. And for some reason I was getting goosebumps listening to you describe this, that maybe that's part of the prophecy being fulfilled.
Well, yes, certainly could be. I have a question for you.
Sure.
That comes from my email inbox. Somebody's asking if you can explain the high traffic on the radio network that's making it so hard to listen to you tonight.
It's probably because you're here, Guy. I don't know. I mean, clearly within the ranks of the United States government, especially with my history with LAPD, CIA, Special Forces, SEALs, and a whole bunch of investigative, counting coup on a CIA director and a Secretary of Defense, maybe a lot of that traffic is just coming directly from U.S. government web servers. Maybe we should say something to those folks.
Sure.
You got a message for them?
I'm sure they're listening. There's no doubt in my mind.
Yeah. I mean, and I have experienced that greatly. And it was, in fact, a testament to the influence that you have had and the growing influence which you are having, that such an effort was directed at your website. Now, combining that with Nafisa's article in The Guardian, the clear fact that the government is fully aware, and this is something that I've been saying for years, it was fully aware about peak oil, the powers that were have known the end result that was coming for a long time. This is it. They are not being surprised now. How does that fit in your cosmology, and how do we try to reconcile that, feeble though you and I may be, with the fact that they're going to die too?
Well, of course. They've known for far longer than most of us have known about everything that's coming. I mean, it's they have large organizations, large institutions, and all they do is collect information and then connect those dots. And so, of course, they know. They know, and they could anticipate where we're at, and they have turned this country into an astonishing police state in preparation for exactly what we're seeing. And what can we do? What can you and I do? What can they do in light of the fact that they've triggered near-term human extinction? I don't know. I don't know what they can do. I know what we can do. As individuals, we can live as though the day we're here, but first do no harm. We can, and this is the gift, if you can view it that way,
yes,
that I give when I deliver presentations, is the gift that the audience members are mortal. And we tend to forget that.
Yes.
And so we go on about our daily lives thinking that we have a long time on this planet, and so we need to prepare for the rainy day and put a bunch of money into our retirement funds and be the office drone that is going to, once we hit our 70s, be able to take advantage of all that money we've saved and do something with our lives. Well, let's do something with our lives right now instead. And so that's the message I have for people at this point in history, is you want to do something? Don't be constrained by cultural pressure. Don't be constrained by your peers who tell you it would be just wacky to go out and do that thing. You want to do something, and it doesn't quite fit with culture, what culture tells you to do and demands you to do, do it anyway.
Do it.
You get one time on this globe. And the people in the know, the high-ranking politicians and the high-ranking corporate members, I suspect they didn't actually know we were going to trigger human extinction until it was too late. And, you know, it was only 2010 that we triggered that we had knowledge that we had triggered the first positive feedback or self-reinforcing feedback loop. And even if they were following the research very closely, they didn't know until 2009. And so the notion of manipulating the system so that money could be made by the people who were in positions to make a lot of money, they just kept going. That was a cultural message. But now it's clearly too late.
Mm-hmm.
What can we do? We can resist. We can resist the dominant paradigm, and we can take those actions that everybody thinks are insane, because it's no longer insane. The whole system is corrupted and insane.
Yes, I guess in a sense I am evolving again, in that I have been enjoying and learning from psychotropic substances, hallucinogens as they would be called, but which Terence McKenna and people all over the world who have experienced this, that I'm referring to ayahuasca and DMT, and I've been getting very clear messages as a result of that, because my question is always, what am I supposed to be doing to serve? And the question now must be, or the statement must be made, Guy, tell me if you agree, that it's not time to worry about whether we're going to die or not. The time is here when we ask ourselves the question, how we're going to die.
Yes. We have still some ability to influence how we are going to die. And for some people, it's going to be an act of choice.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, it's going to be suicide, because going ahead is so unpalatable that leaving seems to be the preferred choice. For some people, it's going to be starvation. You know, Daniel Dumright wrote an essay on my website a few months ago, something like the irrevocable acceptance of near-term extinction. And it was 11,000 words. It was a great piece of writing. It went up and down and around and around, and I can boil it down to three words. Three words. He was proposing the means by which people would die. Predation, starvation, suicide. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that covers a vast majority of people. I suspect a whole bunch of people will die of thirst as well. And most of those people are going to be in cities when collapse visits their city.
And of course, we would have to add those poisoned by acute sudden radiation poisoning then would have to fall in there somewhere if the reactor buildings collapse at Fukushima.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, that might do the whole show before predation, starvation, suicide, or dying of thirst comes into play.
Exactly. And I have to stress that from all the study that I've done, that the rate of acceleration of events is astonishing at this point.
Yes, it is. Like I said, we're seeing geologic events play out in real time, and we're seeing human failure in the form of Fukushima and San Onofre, which has not gone away,
mm-hmm.
and Hanford, which has not gone away. Again, those things are accelerating. There's another thought, too. Maybe the people who used to be in charge, the corporate, quote, leaders and the government, quote, leaders, maybe they're just psychopaths. And so they're addicted. Maybe they're addicted and addicts don't think they will die.
Mm-hmm.
So,
or maybe they seek death, and there's a you know whole lot of subtextual themes to that. But I firmly believe that this paradigm, this system, knows that its ultimate end, it's a zero-sum game, and that's what they seek, and that's what they hunger for. And perhaps if, by some miracle, we could achieve a miraculous change in consciousness of 7 billion people, suddenly that extra scientific from this paradigm answers might become apparent, but also that human consciousness might open doors that are not available to us at the moment. But these bastards absolutely know what they're doing, and they have known for a good long time. And instead of, as the situation gets worse, them easing off the gas pedal, they seem to have just kicked in the nitrous oxide and floored it.
Right, right. And so our response, at least some people, the response is, I came here to chew gum and kick ass, and I'm all out of gum. and so some people are going to fight the irredeemably corrupt system the whole way down.
Mm-hmm.
Other people are going to accept whatever comes their way. And if that includes their near-term demise, well,
hey, it's coming anyway.
It's coming anyway, exactly.
Boy, that has been a point I have tried to drive home, and it has to do with all of the lessons that I've taught over about 2 years now on this show about spirituality and the fact that you don't change until your death is upon you. And you fight better, and you fight smarter when there is nothing left to lose. That's what releases a lot of power. So, all right, I think this might be a good time to play a song, and this is the only song we're going to play tonight. And I picked it very specially because I wanted to emphasize the change in the human heart that is produced. And I can feel, I've spoken to Guy many times, I can feel a shift in our energies tonight as we discuss these things. And those shift in energies and in consciousness makes a huge difference. And it sometimes it can bring forth feelings, it can bring forth vibrations that can produce change. This is a song from the movie The Last Waltz by Martin Scorsese, which was the last performance of the band, the incredible band. And you'll hear Joni Mitchell singing in the background. But here is, let's play this now. Here is Neil Young singing Helpless.
Sweet comfort.
I have known for a long, long time through a lot of experience and a long road walked that it is not until we become helpless that we can find our power. And if you don't get that, ladies and gents, by this point, I hope you do next time around. But that song really seemed to fit tonight, and it also seemed to generate some warm fuzzies, which is what we need right now, and it's what we need to be sharing with each other. If you want to ask Guy McPherson a question, we're in the last quarter of the show. The number is 1-888-874-4888. 1-888-874-4888 here on the Lifeboat Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Got 15 minutes left, Guy. As you scan now and as you have assimilated all these current events into your cosmological picture, what are you looking for near term, short term? What are your antenna out for?
Well, I'm always keeping track of the macroeconomic picture, hoping, trying to push it over, trying to figure out when it's going to go down, trying to help it along its way, and paying careful attention to what's going on in Fukushima, of course, as well as trying to keep up with the climate news. That's enough. This coming weekend, Saturday, there'll be a showing of Mike Sosby's film at Mount Shasta, California.
Oh, beautiful.
If you're anybody's in the area, drop on by Shasta Commons.
Where can people find information on that? Is there a link? Is it on your website?
Yes. All the information is on my website under the tab called Coming Events.
GuyMcPherson.com. Okay.
That's right. And so that'll be fun. Another question and answer series after that. And then there are a couple of filmmakers interested in additional documentary films about me and my efforts, and maybe I can get them to work on one and work together. We'll see how that plays out. So really not much going on. Maybe another tour or two before things fall apart too badly that the money will travel, but we'll see.
Which could happen at any moment, and you know, quite frankly, in my own heart, I'm perfectly accepting of that now. You know, it's like one thing that you and I will not have to question when our time comes is whether we did enough. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
We were on the field, and we know that, and that's a great comfort to both of us. When you were in Amsterdam at this hacker conference, let's weave climate change into the hacker conference and what you presented on there.
Well, I just gave the latest update on the climate change news, and these hackers are activists. They're relatively young for the most part, and they want information. They want information about everything. They want the big picture stuff, and it was an incredibly engaging group of people who were amazingly engaged. They had a spook panel there consisting of Ray McGovern, formerly with the CIA.
Ray's a good friend, yeah.
Colleen Raleigh.
No, Colleen.
From the FBI. Annie Michonne with MI5. Thomas Drake from NSA.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, this is the caliber of people these folks brought in. It wasn't just about hacking. It was about what's going on in the world that we need to know about. It was some of the most intelligent, broad-thinking, knowledgeable human beings I've ever had the pleasure to be around. The conference was capped at 3,000 participants. They could have had another 2,000 easily, but they stopped it at 3,000. It was just a great experience from my perspective.
What was the name of this conference? Is there a name of this group? Can people find it and follow it? Or what?
Oh, yeah. OHM2013.org. That's O-H-M for Observe, Hack, Make. OHM2013.org, and all of the presentations will be posted at some point in the not-too-distant future. They say likely within a few days. And so if you're interested in the big picture, what's going on in the world, that's a great place to start checking. In the not-too-distant future, there'll be a series of presentations available digitally there.
Okay, we have time for a quick call. Phil from Berlin, Connecticut. Are you there?
Wow, thanks, guys. I really appreciate your show, and I want to send a love out to you. Just wanted to ask, I have teenagers. I've tried to live my life, you know, the best I can within my means and all the things that are coming. How do we still create a sense of love and awe for life when we know all the black darkness that's around us?
Go ahead, guy.
That's a great question, and very, very frequently when I talk, there's a lot of bargaining and a lot of negotiating and people looking for hope. And I quote Nietzsche for them, hope in reality is the worst of the evils, for it prolongs man's torment, or the torment of man, rather. I think action is the antidote to despair, that we should be taking action. I think it's, you know, indigenous peoples and many people involved in the first wave of the American Cultural Revolution in the 1960s and 1970s have been sounding the alarms for a long time, and we've chosen instead as a society to chase money. And so I'm pretty sure that's what got us into this state. So I suspect it's far too late to do anything to try to save our species.
Mm-hmm.
And so what does that mean? Live as though the day were here, to quote Nietzsche again, or let go or be dragged.
I would say teach them how to live the way we all are beginning to understand the way we should have lived, so that they will know and have had that experience while they're here. Thank you, Phil. I've got another call. We're running down to the last few minutes, so I want to try to get this in.
Thank you,
Mark,
gentlemen.
Thank you. Mark from Minneapolis, are you there?
Yeah, Mike. Thanks for doing my call. I'm always astonished that whenever I have these conversations, so many people are unaware. But my question about Fukushima is, you know, if we're in uncharted territories with a full-on China syndrome meltdown,
mm-hmm.
We have no idea what's going to happen. This could definitely be an extinction event, could it not?
Guy, you first.
Absolutely. I can't see how we can avoid this being an extinction event. If not on its own, then in concert with climate change or the meltdown of numerous other nuclear power plants, more or less simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
This is a big, big deal. If there's MOX fuel and it's exposed to the air, a few micrograms of MOX floating around the air and ending up in your lungs has you dead in a matter of weeks.
And we are talking about, in both buildings 3 and 4, fuel storage pools. I know 4 has more than 20 years of accumulated fuel rods. The amounts, we are talking of tens and perhaps hundreds of tons of MOX fuel that might open air incinerate. Those numbers are incomprehensible.
Right, and so then it gets taken up in the atmosphere and falls down as rain all over the world, and we're all radiated.
We're toast, yes. And it would follow this now highly meandering, erratic, would you call it spasmodic, guy jet stream?
Yes, and Jennifer Francis at Rutgers has done a great job describing how that came about and what the consequences are on the climate front. But yes, that meandering jet stream is going to take this, just general circulation patterns are going to take this incredibly lethal ionizing radiation throughout the globe in an astonishingly short period of time.
We saw, and I wrote about this at Collapse Net when I was there. I gave a speech, Portland, Oregon, 9/11/11. In which I warned about this because it was documented then that when there was a large venting, the Japanese were actually incinerating radioactive waste, and it saw Geiger counters spiking horrendously in Toronto, where it's like a log scale, guy, I believe, where you're at one level on a Geiger, and then you click, and the next level is 10 times greater, the next level is 10 times greater than that. And so we know that that's the way it's distributed, and that is what we have to fear. Very clearly, it is my opinion and my belief that if Building 3 or Building 4 goes down, first of all, nobody will be able to come within 15 miles of the reactors, all of them, so they will all go. But if either one topples over, it's entirely possible, and I've heard somebody else say this, the West Coast could be uninhabitable, or wherever the jet stream goes, within a matter of days or weeks.
That's going to be inconvenient. You know, we should have been taking this seriously a long time ago.
Yes.
And because it takes at least two decades to safely decommission a nuclear power plant. We have now well over 400 of them, and nobody's interested in starting the process of decommissioning any of them.
Right. Well, San Onofre was a lucky stroke week, but, you know, there's not counting the reactors in the naval vessels around the world, those in government labs. There are 440, 450 commercial reactors on the planet, and many of them are already rickety as hell anyway. We are down to the last couple of minutes. Thank you, Mark from Minneapolis, for calling in with that. Guy, I just want to say to you personally, you know, I'm kind of a veterano out here. I'm kind of an old guy on the field, but it is an honor. And it is so comforting to see somebody as absolutely crazy and as I am out here, younger with as much fortitude as you have, and really carrying the message. And I think we'll both agree that we are not alone now. There's more and more people standing up all the time, and these acts of heroism make a great deal of difference in the world. And to some extent, you and I are leaders. Are you taking encouragement? Are you seeing signs that more and more people are willing to do the right thing, like we have walked in our path?
Well, yes, of course. I'm actually shocked anytime I see people doing the right thing. I'm afraid, though, that they aren't keeping up with just the number of people we're adding to the planet every day.
So, quarter of a million, right? Something like that?
Just over 200,000 a day. That's births minus deaths. So, you know, just the births alone are over a quarter million. So that's a little disheartening, because I don't run across a quarter million people a day who are jumping on board with living out differently, with chasing something besides fiat currency.
Well, I think the important thing is that there are people like Bradley Manning, like Edward Snowden, like my friend Dan Ellsberg, and you and me and so many others who have been, we weren't just the average quarter of a million people a day. We were people in a position who saw something and were in a position to say something and did so. And in that, you and I both hope, gave inspiration and showed the way for those who we hope will come behind us.
Well, and absolutely. And not only that, it's not as if we're doing what we're doing because it will generate a huge amount of influence. It's not as if I can live differently regardless.
Right.
It's something within us, and not something that is external.
Well, that's the answer that the spiritual thing says all along. The answer is within. And that's where we have to go, to our hearts, to be there and to vibrate in love. And if there's somebody that makes me feel that many things are worth loving, it's Guy McPherson and so many others. I've reached out to Derek Jensen. Hopefully he might be able to join us next week. Guy, you are always welcome here, but you better know that around the Lifeboat Hour, you are like most favorite person.
Well, thanks very much, Mike. I appreciate the opportunity.
Keep doing what you do, brother.
Thank you.
Bye. Good night, everybody. I'll be back with you next week. You can't get rid of me that easy. I love you. It's Tracker of Truth. Out. See ya.